Thank you, Ken. And hello, everyone. And yes, Ken said, I am here for I am that. I think that's funny. I am here for I am that. The message that I'm reading from, I don't know if you were here 2 weeks ago, but it's a pretty straightforward message. The message that I'm reading from is called What is Born Must Die. And we got about halfway through that message. So we have a whole hour now. We used to only have half an hour for I Am That, but now that I'm on Wednesday nights, we have a whole hour. So maybe we'll be able to finish this message. It's message number 5. Before I do that, though, I'm going to play a song. This song goes perfectly with this message, What is Born Must Die. Some of you guys may know this song. It's by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and it's called And When I Die. Shit, I didn't know the cowboy version.
Don't want to die uneasy. Just let me go naturally. And when I die, and when I'm dead, dead and gone, there'll be one child. In a world to carry on, yeah.
go. There we go. So that's kind of a review of what Gadatta said last week or 2 weeks ago, actually, when I was here. So as I mentioned, I am reading from I Am That, message number 5, What is Born Must Die. And I'm going to be beginning at the bottom of the page with a question. What is this sense of a separate existence? Nisargadatta answers, it is a reflection in a separate body of the one reality. In this reflection, the unlimited and the limited are confused and taken to be the same. To undo this confusion is the purpose of yoga. And by the way, when he says yoga, he's not talking about exercises. For those of you who don't know, yoga really points to any type of practice that returns us to the realization of oneness. So when he says yoga, I'm sure he means meditating on I Am. But again, what is this sense of separate existence? It's really a fantastic, fantastic answer to the question. It is a reflection in a separate body of the one reality. In this reflection, the unlimited, which of course is consciousness, and the limited, which of course is the body-mind personality, are confused and taken to be the same. To undo this confusion is the purpose of yoga. I was talking to a friend earlier today, and she told me that up until recently, in the introduction to A Course in Miracles, where it says, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, that she thought she, the body personality, maybe not the body, but at least the personality mind, was the something real that could not be threatened. And it just kind of hit her recently that she's been wrong all this time. That the personality mind and, of course, the body personality mind are temporary and are going to end. You know, I think a lot of people do the same thing. You know, I think most people accept, at least most people in our spiritual path, accept that the body is temporary. But there's some kind of an idea that this me, this personality mind, this me, is going to somehow be eternal. And what Nisargadatta is saying here is that's not the case. Again, it's confusing. It's the part of the course that says nothing real can be threatened. It's confusing the me, personality, mind, with the something real, right? We are the life awareness, not the personality mind. The body, the personality, and the mind are the limited. And limited means temporal, transient, impermanent guy. And we think we are the personality mind, which is why we want to believe that the personality mind somehow continues. But we aren't the personality mind. That's the confusion. It's like what he says in this last sentence here, to undo this confusion is the purpose of yoga. That's the confusion. For those of you who are students of A Course in Miracles calls it level confusion. The idea that you are the personality mind. Even if you realize you're not the body, still thinking you're the personality mind. or the life awareness, which is, we could say, something entirely different. That life awareness does not die, which means we do not die, not what we really are. But what we take ourselves to be does. Which is, again, what this conversation is all about and why I opened with the song that I opened with. And I think that, you know, I don't know if Meg was here last time I taught this, and I don't know if Zita was here last time I taught this, but maybe other than those two, I think nearly everybody else that was here last time isn't here. So maybe one go around with this message was enough. I don't know. But again, the question we just read is, what is this sense of a separate existence? It is a reflection in a separate body of the one reality, the one reality. In this reflection, the unlimited and the limited are confused and taken to be the same. To undo this confusion is the purpose of yoga. I like this next question. The questioner says, does not death undo this confusion? That's a good question. Okay, so Nisargadatta says, in death, only the body dies. Life does not, consciousness does not, reality does not. And the life is never so alive as after death. Now, again, he's referring to the life awareness, right? In death, only the body dies. Life does not, consciousness does not, reality does not. And the life is never so alive as after death. And so the questioner says, but does one get reborn? And Nisargadatta says, what was born must die. Only the unborn is deathless. Find what it is that never sleeps and never wakes, and whose pale reflection is our sense of I. So again, what happens is people, nearly all people, confuse themselves with not only the body, but the personality mind. And there's this idea that somehow I, with I meaning personality mind, or at least mind, I am going to survive. Either I am going to go to heaven, or I am going to go to hell. I love the song we just listened to, where it says something like, I don't think there's a heaven, but I pray there's no hell. or you know, what came to us from the Hindu tradition is that I am going to be reincarnated. Right? But there's this idea that I, and that I there is the false self. False. You hear that word, false? It's not true. There's this idea that somehow the I, the false self, is eternal. And whether we think it's eternal in heaven, eternal in hell, eternal through reincarnation, or eternal through different time dimensions, we keep thinking it's eternal. And it's not. Awakening is all about awakening to that part of us, the life awareness that is eternal. It's awakening from the idea that we are the body, the personality, and the mind. So again, Nisargadatta says, what was born must die. Only the unborn is deathless. Find what it is that never sleeps and never wakes, and whose pale reflection is our sense of I. So what never sleeps, you know, that's not what I would call my human consciousness, because my human consciousness goes to sleep, I assure you. And in fact, he's referring to human consciousness as a pale reflection, right? a pale reflection of the truth. Human consciousness, I once read, and I think it might have been Ramana Maharshi, but I could be wrong, might even have been Nisargadatta, but I once read that human consciousness is like the light of the moon. In fact, tonight we have this brilliant moon, and last night we had this brilliant moon, right? It's 14% bigger than usual. It's called a supermoon. It's very bright. And so you see the moonlight, and it lights up outside. You can see better when you have this big, bright moon than you can when there's no moon, right? Because the moonlight. The moonlight's a facade. There's no such thing. The moon has no light. It's the sun's light. The sun's light hits that rock that we call the moon. And then it reflects off of that, and we call it the moonlight, but it's the sun's light. Well, human consciousness is the same kind of thing. Human consciousness is like the moonlight. And consciousness that we awaken to beyond human consciousness is like the sunlight. And life awareness that we awaken to beyond consciousness is like the sun itself. What we want to do is make the human consciousness, what we call I, right? We want to make this be eternal. We want to make the moonlight eternal. How can you make the moonlight eternal when the moonlight doesn't even exist? It's a facade. So awakening isn't about making me eternal somehow, wise and eternal. Awakening is about seeing that I never was the moonlight. I'm the sunlight. And then eventually, with the second awakening, I'm the sun, the source itself. And of course, the sun and the sunlight we could call eternal, right? The sunlight is eternal because it comes from the sun, which is eternal, you know, in this example. As long as there's a sun, there's going to be a sunlight. So what was born must die. Only the unborn is deathless. Find what it is that never sleeps and never wakes, and whose pale reflection is our sense of I. And so the questioner asks, I'm having lots of trouble reading. It's like the words are dancing around. It's like I temporarily have dyslexia. The words are changing order for me. How am I to go about finding this out? How do you go about finding anything? Says Nisargadatta, by keeping your mind and heart on it. There must be interest and steady remembrance. To remember what needs to be remembered is the secret of success. You come to it through earnestness. Well, I told you that I was speaking to a friend today who mentioned that she was realizing now that when the Course says, nothing real can be threatened. This putting, you know, her personality mind, let's say her name was Sally, she was putting the Sally personality mind in the real category. And that she just realized that's wrong. And she's going through what we would call a period of disorientation right now. She's going through a shit, what am I doing here if I'm just gonna die kind of place, but that's perfectly natural when you start having this realization. So I understand, but that's kind of where she's at right now. But what I told her when I was talking to her is I said, well, you know, it's interesting because I can't tell you the number of times that it runs through my mind on a daily basis that Regina is going to die. You know, it's almost like he says, you hold it in your mind and your heart. It's held in my mind and my heart. It's held in remembrance. You know, I look down, I see my body in the shower, and the thought crosses my mind, this body is going to die. Not in a morbid way. It's not morbid. I notice the mind chattering about whatever the heck it's chattering about if it has a chance to do so. And I look right at that mind chattering. I think, that mind is, it's going to die. You know, I look at what people call Regina, whether it be the, you know, it's really kind of the personality body. And I say, you know, that's going to die. That is going to die. And then I pay attention to consciousness. I pay attention to awareness. I pay attention to that which is prior to the mind. And I keep my attention with that. Because I know that by going deeper and deeper into that, I transcend fully the belief that I am this body, mind, personality. I realize what is unborn. And in that way, I know what is real and what is eternal. But there's nothing in me anymore trying to make me eternal. I'm really contemplating this is going to die. And again, it may sound morbid, but I don't think it is. I think that probably if you talk to a lot of masters, they would tell you that they went through the same contemplation. In fact, if you read The Untethered Soul, one of the chapters near the back of the book is the contemplation of death. I once caught Muji briefly talking about how valuable it is to contemplate your death. Sounds morbid, but what you're really doing is you're undoing that confusion that you are this thing that's going to die. You're undoing that confusion. You're looking at it as an object, and you're saying, that's going to die. And so you're undoing the idea that you're the temporary, that you're the impermanent. So again, the questioner says, how am I to go about finding this out? And Nisargadatta says, how do you go about finding anything? By keeping your mind and heart on it. You know, there's a great story in the Bible about a woman who had 10 coins and she lost one coin. And Jesus talks about how she swept her house clean day and night until she found that lost coin. Was sweeping her house clean day and night until she found that lost coin represents us being constantly focused on letting go of the false belief that I'm this personality, body, mind, and staying with the attention on awareness, life presence as what I am. Until that shift occurs, where that's an absolute sincerity, certainty, and direct experience. That's sweeping our house clean until we find that lost coin. That's keeping our mind and heart on it. So how am I to go about finding this out? How do you go about finding anything? By keeping your mind and heart on it. There must be interest and steady remembrance. Not everybody has the interest. And so, of course, it's not how they're going to spend their day. But as the interest arises, it is, like I said, I can't tell you the number of times per day. I mean, this is something that nobody else would notice because it's happening, you could call it privately, or it's not really a secret, but, you know, secretly, like Jesus said, go into your closet and pray, right? It's happening inside the closet. You know, even if I'm outside with friends, it's happening inside where there's this noticing that this is going to die. And then focusing on awareness. But when there's interest, It's natural to, and if you guys know me well, you know I call this playing games. It's natural to play this game. I feel like I am not playing a game in that it's unreal or unimportant, just that I have fun doing it. I have fun remaining in this contemplation regardless of what I'm doing, because there's interest, right? If you have interest in something, you have fun. If you have interest in collecting coins, you have fun collecting coins. You know, if you have interest in sports, you have fun playing or watching sports. And if you have interest in quilting, you have fun quilting. For somebody else, the same activity could be torturous. So I have interest in contemplating the mortality of Regina and seeking through paying attention to consciousness that which was never born. I have interest in it, therefore it is fun, and that's why I call it a game. So, again, how am I to go about finding this out? How do you go about finding anything? By keeping your mind and heart on it. There must be interest and steady remembrance. To remember what needs to be remembered is the secret of success. That's kind of a funny sentence. To remember what needs to be remembered is the secret of success. But the way I interpret that sentence is that he is saying, you know, to remember to play this game all the time of noticing the mortality of the person and keeping attention with consciousness or awareness. To remember to do that all the time is the secret of success. Right? Consistency is the secret to success. Earnestness, he often says, is the secret to success. To remember what needs to be remembered is the secret of success. You come to it through earnestness. There we go. It's one of his most popular words, earnestness. So the questioner says, do you mean to say that mere wanting to find out is enough? Surely both qualifications and opportunities are needed. Qualifications and opportunities. Nisargadatta says, these will come with earnestness. What is supremely important is to be free from contradictions. The goal and the way must not be on different levels. Life and light must not quarrel. Behavior must not betray belief. Call it honesty, integrity, wholeness. You must not go back, undo, uproot, and abandon the conquered ground. Tenacity of purpose and honesty in pursuit will bring you to your goal. So what this makes me think of is if, for example, you know, right now I spend about 2.5 hours of an average morning, not while Lisa's here, but I spend about 2.5 hours of an average morning in contemplation and meditation. And that's even before I go to the gentle healing contemplation and writing the tip, because I call that my job. And that's even really extended contemplation and meditation. So that's another hour and a half. If you add that on, we're talking, what, 4 hours a day of focused contemplation and meditation. So let's pretend like I spend this 4 hours a day in contemplation and meditation. And then I call up Lisa on the phone, and I gossip about Sonia. And then I call up Sonia on the phone, and you know, somehow she's heard about this, and I lie to her about it. Say, "Oh no, no, Lisa lied to you. I never said that." You know, that's what he's talking about: doing and undoing. Right? I'm not living in my integrity. I spend 4 hours a day in meditation and contemplation, but when I get up from my meditation and contemplation, I become disingenuous. Maybe I, get drunk every night. I get high every night. I've known a lot of spiritual people who still get drunk and get high at night. There are spiritual people who have sexual relations outside of what is honest. Like, there's nothing wrong with sexual relations, but like, you're married and you don't want your wife to find out that you're having the sexual relations, right? That's sexual relations outside of what is honest. There are plenty of spiritual people who still do that. Plenty of spiritual teachers who do that. So that's what he's talking about. You get up, you do your meditation, your contemplation, but then you undo because you go into your life and you continue to live from your self-centered ego. That's not going to cut it. This is an all-the-time commitment. You need to remain with your integrity. If you're in gentle healing right now, one of the things I talked about on Sunday night was that you stay with conscience. You don't abandon conscience. You don't wake up to the point where you can say, I don't need to pay attention to conscience anymore. I'm beyond that. Conscience guides us in a way to reduce human suffering. That's really the purpose of conscience, to reduce human suffering. When you stay in harmony with your conscience, you remain with your integrity. Like we all know not to gossip, don't we? We all know, in most cases, not to lie. The reason I say in most cases is we do have an agreement in my family that it's okay to lie in order to surprise somebody, like at Christmas and birthdays. So that's an agreement. So those are honest lies, because we all agree on those lies, right? It's okay to lie to surprise somebody for Christmas or birthday if you need to. But for the most part, we know it's not okay to lie. We know it's not okay to steal. We know it's not okay to cheat on our taxes. It's really not even okay to cheat at a game of Monopoly. We know this stuff. So we need to live in that way. So again, do you mean that the mere wanting to find out is enough? Surely both qualifications and opportunities are needed. And Nisargadatta says these will come with earnestness, right? The qualifications will come and the opportunities will come. What is supremely important is to be free from contradictions. See how he goes right there? That's because so many spiritual people aren't free from contradictions. What is supremely important is to be free from contradictions. The goal and the way must not be on different levels. The goal, wanting to awaken, and the way you live your life must not be on different levels. Life and light must not quarrel. Again, the way you live your life and the spiritual teaching that you are contemplating must not quarrel. They need to be the same, in harmony. Behavior must not betray belief. Call it honesty, integrity, wholeness. You must not go back and undo, uproot, and abandon the conquered ground. Tenacity of purpose and honesty in pursuit will bring you to your goal. Be whole, right? Be in harmony with the clarity that you've achieved, and more will come. Peace Pilgrim used to say, as I lived up to the highest light that I had, higher light was given, right? But you don't live up to the highest light that you have by continuing to gossip and lie and cheat or, whatever else you do, right? You live up to the highest light you have by living up to the highest light you have. And then more light is given. We have to be whole. The questioner says, tenacity and honesty are endowments. Surely, I do not have a trace of them. And Nisargadatta says, all will come as you go on. Take the first step first. All blessings come from within. Turn within. I am, you know. Be with it all the time you can spare until you revert to it spontaneously. There is no simpler and easier way. So I love that. Take the first step first. And, you know, as you do that, the next step will come and the next step will come. And eventually the tenacity and the honesty comes, and then the earnestness comes, and then you're becoming qualified, and then the opportunities come. Like, it all happens, but you got to take that first step, and you really do need to do your best. Didn't we have a conversation about this? Yeah. You really do need to do your best in the beginning. Your best may be, you know, in even the judgment of your ego, supremely, you know, unqualified. But as you do your best, your genuine best, no matter how supremely unqualified it appears, as you do your genuine best, your best naturally gets better. As you live up to the highest light that you have, higher light is given. So it's just a matter of always doing your best. And no, nobody can ask you to do better than your best anyway, but you don't want to do less than your best out of some sense of, I don't know. You know, part of me wants to say laziness, but I don't think that's 100% true. I don't know that anybody is really lazy. Even the person who lays on TV, on the couch all day watching TV, they're just being where they want to be. And I don't think that's actually laziness. So it's really just a matter of wanting to have integrity and wanting to do your best and see where this road goes. So again, all will come as you go on. Take the first step first. All blessings come from within. Turn within. I am, you know. Be with it all the time you can spare until you revert to it spontaneously. There is no simpler and easier way. And that is the end of the message, what is born must die. So that takes me then to message number 6. And since we have 20 minutes, I will just go ahead and begin the next message. And number 6, oh, I don't have water. Okay, well, I'll get a drink of water in 20 minutes. Usually I have water right here. I guess you'll get me some. Thank you. It's so nice about having company. I have someone to get me some water. Yeah, this should be recorded, Sonia. I think Ken is recording this, yes. So the next message is called meditation. Message number 6, the questioner says, all teachers advise to meditate. So obviously this is not in the West, because in the West, not all teachers advise to meditate, although most of the ones we interview here at Satsang do. But the questioner says, all teachers advise to meditate. What is the purpose of meditation? And Nisargadatta says, actually, I hear my water coming. I'm going to wait and have a drink of water, and then I'll read that answer. Thank you. That strange noise you hear is my water bottle, in case you're trying to figure out what that noise is. It's not me whistling while I drink. It's my water bottle whistling while I drink. Okay. All teachers advise to meditate. What is the purpose of meditation? Nisargadatta says, We know the outer world of sensations and actions, but of our inner world of thoughts and feelings, we know very little. The primary purpose of meditation is to become conscious of and familiar with our inner life. The ultimate purpose is to reach the source of life and consciousness. Incidentally, I don't know why I think it's funny. I can't imagine Nisargadatta saying incidentally, but I guess he did. Incidentally, practice of meditation deeply affects our character. We are slaves to what we do not know. Of what we know, we are masters. Whatever vice or weakness in ourselves, we discover and understand its causes and its workings. We overcome it by the very knowing. The unconscious dissolves when brought to the conscious. The dissolution of the unconscious releases energy. The mind feels adequate and becomes quiet. So this is a pretty good answer, which we'll look at, you know, slowly. Again, the question was, all teachers advise to meditate. What is the purpose of meditation? And Nisargadatta says, we know the outer world of sensations and actions, like we're all outward focused, right? But of our inner world of thoughts and feelings, we know very little. And this may not be 100% true of those of you who hear my voice, but this is true of the average person in the world. This was certainly true of me when I started the spiritual path. In fact, when I started the spiritual path, I was unaware of the fact that my mind talked all of the time. It still talked all of the time. And I listened to it all of the time. You know, if it told me to, you know, if it was talking about how I needed to feel stressed because I'm not getting this done, I felt stressed. You know, if, you know, I listened to it all the time. It talked all the time. I responded to it all of the time. And I was completely unaware of it. It seems to me when I first started reading the course and started getting the idea that it was, you know, trying to teach me that the mind talked all the time, you know, my thought was like, not my mind. Well, it did. And, you know, it really kind of still does. I've just learned not to pay as much attention to it. So if that was true for me, and I don't think I'm an extraordinary idiot. So if that was true of me, it's probably true of almost everybody out there. Jamie just looked at me like, yes, you are an extraordinary idiot. Because you do all this dang teaching instead of playing with me all the time. So that means that nearly everybody out there is walking around with their mind chattering all of the time, and they're completely responding emotionally and physically to what the mind says, and they're completely unaware of it. Now, all of us have been involved in this path enough and paid attention enough, we know about the chattering mind. We're not ignorant about the chattering mind, and hopefully everyone here has learned at least not to listen to the mind 100% anymore. Hopefully we're all cutting that down somewhat, right? You know, we were at 100% probably when we started, but now we're at 90 or 80 or 70 or 60 or somewhere. We're not listening to at least some of it now because we're realizing, you know, that it's not as wise as it pretends to be. But what Nisargadatta is saying is the purpose of meditation is to see what's going on in the mind. That's in the beginning. He goes on to another purpose. The way Adyashanti teaches what he calls true meditation is that you sit down and you close your eyes. And then you just let everything be as it is. You don't change anything. You just watch it. So if the mind starts, bad-mouthing your neighbor, you don't you don't let your attention go all the way into it where you're right there. Yeah, you know, my neighbor, you know, you hang back. But you just be aware of the mind bad-mouthing the neighbor. And then the mind starts worrying about the stock market crashes and you watch that. And then the mind goes off somewhere else and you watch that. And then the mind goes off somewhere else and you watch that. And what you become aware of, because again, we're starting at the beginning level here, what you become aware of is that chattering mind. You know, maybe you start noticing that the mind is going over and over this conversation you have with somebody yesterday, but each time it goes over it, you know, you say something a little smarter than the last time. You're getting smarter and smarter in the conversation, you know, meaning with your comebacks and such. And you start, and you become aware of the fact of, wow, this mind just talks all the time, and I listen to it all of the time. You know, you start waking up to that. That's the first purpose of meditation. I remember for me, I didn't really consider myself meditating, but I went on a 5-day silent retreat once. It was the first time I'd ever been on a silent retreat. And we weren't allowed, well, I actually made the rules. I was the facilitator, so I can't blame anybody else for the rules but me. But the rules were, we weren't allowed to read. We weren't allowed to write. We weren't allowed to be on a cell phone or be on a computer. Obviously, we weren't allowed to talk to anyone. So there was nothing at all to distract you from being alone with your mind. And I didn't sit and meditate much. I did a little bit, but for the most part, I mean, I maybe meditated 1 to 2 hours a day. But for the most part, I walked because this was out in the woods, and I would walk and walk and walk, sit on a rock for a while, then walk and sit on another rock for a while. That's all I did. And the mind just, and I remember distinctly, this is embarrassing. Hopefully you guys are, what would you call me, Jamie? Would you call me a while ago, an idiot or something? Extraordinary idiot. Okay. Hopefully you guys are extraordinary idiots too, so I won't look too stupid. But I remember one time I'm sitting there on a rock, like this is like my second or third day at the retreat, like nothing's going on, you're not doing anything, so there's really nothing for the mind to think about, but it thinks anyway. And I'm sitting on this rock, oh, this is embarrassing. I'm sitting on this rock in the sun, and my mind is chattering about, boy, what if Brad Pitt walked by right now? Having this conversation with Brad Pitt in my mind, and I just went, oh my God, you're like, this thing will think about anything. Well, I think it was probably the fourth day of the silent retreat that the mind actually started to quiet down. And when the mind started to quiet down, the world became more alive. I mean, it was amazing, but I'm sure many of you have experienced this too. The colors were more vibrant, and I could feel the life in everything. I could feel the life in the trees, in the grass, in the insects, in the rocks, you know, and it was just incredible. And as I went further into this mind that had quieted down, it was not completely silent, but, you know, a whole lot more silent. It just ran out of things to talk about. I felt in communion with everything, like with a blade of grass. I was in communion relationship, but it's a sameness relationship. Like I am life, and the blade of grass is life. We're the same, and you know what a joy to be here together now. And I was just in communion for the next 2 days, the last 2 days of retreat. I was just in this gorgeous communion with everything. Everything was life. Everything was the same as me. Everything was relationship. It's both oneness and relationship at the same time. And what happened with this silent retreat, it was kind of interesting because we had this 5-day silent retreat. And at the end of the 5-day silent retreat in the same location, there was a 3-day conference, spiritual conference with multiple speakers. And I was one of those speakers. And so at the end of the last day of the retreat, all these people started arriving that were coming to this conference, and it started getting busy, and you had to, you know, do this and do this. And again, I was one of the speakers, so I got pulled into that. And about 2 hours into that, I noticed Oh my God, I'm walking right by trees and not even noticing them anymore. You know, I went right back into the mind and right back into the busyness. And it's like, you know, a while ago, these trees were my brothers and my sisters, you know, like Saint Francis, right? Brother, sun, sister, moon. You know, a while ago, these trees were my brothers and my sisters, and I was in relationship with them. And now I'm just walking by like they're dead things, you know, planted in a dead earth. So the purpose of meditation, even though, again, I wasn't meditating, the purpose of meditation is to become aware of the mind, to become conscious of the mind, familiar with that inner life, and although he doesn't say this, to eventually lose interest in it. And then when you lose interest in it, you transcend it. And you begin to become aware of life itself in the way that I did in that silent retreat. And in fact, you can go further and further into that where you become aware of the source of life. Like I said earlier, you know, life itself would be like the sunbeams, right? Like the light of the moon is really just a facade. But the life is the sunbeams, the life that I was experiencing in the trees and the rocks and the grass and, of course, myself. But then you keep going with that and you come to the source, the sun itself. It's like two awakenings. The first awakening is to consciousness, to the oneness of consciousness, unity consciousness. The second awakening is to that which is beyond consciousness. A Course in Miracles calls it a awakening to the real world, and then awakening to heaven, or awakening to true perception, and then awakening beyond perception entirely. So this is the purpose of meditation, all three of these. First, just to become aware of your lazy mind, because again, most people aren't. To really look at it and recognize it for what it is. Notice how much your mind tells you you're a fat, ugly loser, or whatever your mind says. You're stupid. You're an extraordinary idiot. Right? Notice what's going on. How your mind worries about things. I remember when I first started watching my mind, you know, my mind worried about the future a lot. And one day I sat down and I wrote down how many things that I could remember that I had really, really worried about in my past. You know, and how many of those things happened? And it was like almost none of them, you know, just like it was just all negative fantasy. And it had no foot in any reality, not even this illusory world. It was completely made up crap in the mind that I was listening to enough that I experienced anxiety, fear, worry, and none of it ever even happened. You know, these are the kinds of things we need to see. Because we see this clearly, then we start losing interest in it. If it's that unreliable, then why would I pay attention to it? So that's kind of the first step, to notice it's nasty to me. It's unreliable. It doesn't know what it's talking about. It's just replaying an old conversation. It's imagining Brad Pitt walking by. I mean, you know, this thing is, it's useless. Why should I give it so much attention? That's the first step. And then we become aware of what's beyond it. And we begin to commune with that. And through communing with that, which is beyond the mind, we go even beyond that to the source. And that's the purpose of meditation. Let's see if we missed anything. So the question is, all teachers advise to meditate. What is the purpose of meditation? Nisargadatta says, we know the outer world of sensations and actions, but of our inner world of thoughts and feelings, we know very little. The primary purpose of meditation is to become conscious of and familiar with our inner life. Here he's talking about emotions and thoughts. The ultimate purpose, right? Because that's just where you start. The ultimate purpose is to reach the source of life and consciousness. So you start by becoming aware of that human inner life, thoughts and emotions, but you go all the way to the sun, all the way to the source of life and consciousness. Incidentally, practice of meditation deeply affects our character. We are slaves to what we do not know, which I've already talked about, right? The mind starts worrying about, you know, oh my goodness, I'm not going to do a good job on this, and the boss is going to find out I'm a fake, and blah, blah. And, you know, we don't even know we're listening, and we're getting all stressed, and then we get grumpy at somebody, and we yell at them. You know, we're slaves to the mind that we don't see. So practice of meditation deeply affects our character. We are slaves to what we do not know, but of what we know, we're masters, because we can see it chattering. We can see it saying all of that stuff, and we can be wise enough not to listen to it. So in awareness, we have the chance to choose not to listen. In non-awareness, we blindly listen. Whatever vice or weakness in ourselves we discover and understand its causes and its workings, right? Through watching the mind, we understand, for example, why we're mean to our children. You know, I used to be mean to Jasmine, and I found out it was because I felt so unworthy. I did not want her to grow up to be as unworthy as me. So I wanted her to take all of these lessons and be me. And because she, you know, sometimes, you know, was slow to go from practicing piano to practicing Chinese to practicing math to practicing reading, I was like a drill sergeant yelling at her because she needed to get all this stuff done so she'd get in bed by 8 o'clock, because she had to be this really superior child so she didn't grow up to be as unworthy as me. See, I was driven by unworthiness to be mean to my child. These are the kinds of things you see when you start really watching the mind. And then you're like, wow. You know, wow. And you can start to change it. But you can't start to change it till you see it. So whatever vice or weaknesses in ourselves we discover and understand its causes and its workings, we overcome it by the very knowing. The unconscious dissolves when brought into the conscious. When you don't see it, you're a slave to it. When you do see it, you can change it. The dissolution of the unconscious releases energy. And I don't understand. I got to admit, I don't understand this next part. The mind feels adequate and becomes quiet. I don't know exactly what the mind feels adequate means, but I do know what it means when it becomes quiet. You know, you quit believing all that stuff. It quits revolving in the mind, and eventually it just kind of peters out because you're not feeding it with your attention. So, next week, or actually it's 2 weeks when I'm back again. 2 weeks from now, I'll look at this next question and answer. But it's interesting because the last thing Nisargadatta said is, again, after you really watch the mind and learn about it and transcend it, then the mind becomes quiet, right? And the next question is, what's the use of a quiet mind? So that's my cliffhanger. So come back in 2 weeks. And let's find out what's the use of a quiet mind. So I'm going to take about 30 seconds, Ken, and then I'll type a name for you into the room. I just need to look at it and think about it. I'm releasing the mic.